In 2020, Rear Admiral Bruce Gillingham, the Surgeon General of the Navy, launched a professional reading list of books that have helped shape his perspective as a doctor, naval officer, and leader over the course of 3 decades of service. Each book corresponds with one of Navy medicine's priorities and are categorized under people, platforms, performance, or power. To strengthen understanding of these priorities and the application of reading lists to Navy medicine, Rear Admiral Gillingham began a special conversation series with the book's authors in November 2020. The following is a recording of a conversation that took place on June 8, 2021, with Commander Retired Richard Jaddick, author of On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is Admiral Gillingham, a Navy Surgeon General. And it's a particular thrill today to have Dr. Richard Jaddick join us as we discuss his book, On Call in Hell, a book that was written a couple of years after his experiences during Operation Alpha Jar, the second Marine Corps invasion into Fallujah. For those who have read the book or know Dr. Jaddick, you know that he is a Navy medical alumnus and taught us a lot about how to operate out forward. He was a Marine officer initially, and we'll have him describe this, had a conversation while doing some training with a battalion surgeon who told him it was possible to become a medical officer. And he subsequently did that, did some urology training, but then volunteered to fill a hot fill spot as a battalion surgeon with a unit heading to Iraq. And in that experience, I was able to bring significant Marine Corps experience to really improve the care that was able to be provided literally at the tip of the spear. And so, Dr. Jaddick, just for your awareness and for the group, when I took over as the Surgeon General, I started a SG's reading list. It wasn't an assignment or homework. It was just books that I had found particularly compelling and valuable in my career and wanted to share. And one of the ways that we're seeking to popularize the list and create interest and encourage Navy medical personnel to read both personally and professionally is to have authors come on and discuss their books. And so we were thrilled when you were you agreed to participate and discuss On Call in Hell. So with that, if you'd like to just share maybe some of your reflections now, 17 years on from the Battle of Fallujah, and sorts of things that upon reflection you've now realized.
Well, I mean, I guess the number one thing that I realized is how much I truly miss the Navy and the military and that camaraderie that comes with being with a team, being able to kind of analyze a mission and put your point into that mission so that the mission's successful. So I do that every day with the operating room and the team that I have here, but I truly enjoyed my time in the Navy. Loved it every second of it, and really, at some point you have to retire. You get too old for that game, but I regret it. 17 years later, those lessons that I think I learned during my time, A, as a Marine Corps officer, B, as a Navy medical officer, and then C, in some combat zones, are things that I think about every day. I think truly about how to treat people, how important it is to be there, kind of at the pointy end of the spear on every day. When people come in to me now with bad cancers and they want to talk that through, I go back to my Fallujah days when I thought, well, I had to be really forward to do something good. And that's the same thing here. I have to be forward. I have to be straightforward with patients. I have to understand what they're going to go through as opposed to kind of sitting back and letting it happen.
Well, that's terrific. And One of the things that you know that we're emphasizing in Navy medicine is adopting the principles of high reliability, and one of those is the concept of rapid cycle feedback. You encounter a situation, it's not exactly as you anticipated, and you adjust. And I think one of the compelling stories in your book is the recognition during that initial rescue mission that even though you had tried to get as far forward as you could at checkpoint 84, that you recognized that you still weren't close enough. And so could you walk us through that decision-making process, knowing the additional risk that you were going to assume?
Yeah, that actually started on our motor march to Fallujah off of the Haditha Dam. And my Colonel Brandel had said to me at some stop checkpoint or something, he had said, "Hey, Doc, how do we get my Marines home?" And my thoughts at that time were, "Wow, I can't stop them from getting injured. We're going into battle. They're going to get shot. Some are going to get blown up. How do I process all that to get them home?" Because that's what he's asking me. He wants me to help him in this mission. And all I could think of was I got to push my forward aid station, as close as possible to get some life-saving trauma support as far forward as possible. My initial concept was right there at the forward edge of the battle area, the FEBA. I thought, hey, we're going to be within a couple of miles of anybody on the battlefield and they can evac to us. I also knew there'd be no airlift over Fallujah. So it was all motor vehicle. And then on the initial push into the city, I think we had only moved about a block, maybe two blocks when the call came in for the chest wound. I had a Marine down with a chest wound, a sniper. And we started to move in, and I realized then, as I got off the mobile assault platoon outside the Humvee, I realized how the security risks. Now, when I first got the call, I jumped into a truck and went down forward, knowing that I was probably dealing with a sucking chest wound. Didn't know what kind of medical was on scene at the time. And then as I was processing all this, as I got off at the edge of the battle and started moving towards the battle, we were able to locate the Marine. There's two things I realized there, that security is extremely important. And you're not going to be providing security as the medical officer, nor are your corpsmen. The medical teams are there to do one mission, and the Marine teams for me were there to do the other mission. And so I had to be able to separate those two things, and I had to be able to, and this sounds so simple, is locate things in the battle area under complete chaos. I had maps, I had things, I knew how to read coordinates, but once you get into that fire zone, things start to get a little hazy, and you have to be able to adjust and run on the fly. We were able to get there, we were able to put an Asherman chest seal on that Marine and evacuate him. And fortunately, he's still alive today. But on my ride back and getting him out of that vehicle, I realized we had a second wound come in, a groin wound that we were able to literally stop the bleeding very quickly. When we were able to stop the bleeding very quickly, he had just been shot as we were leaving. He was part of my assault platoon. I realized, well, if we're closer, even closer than this, we can start to really save lives. So, the trauma saving is more putting tourniquets on things, stopping bleeding, getting them out of there as quickly as possible. And that's when that night I presented it to my colonel. I said, I think I need to go forward if we want to get Marines home. And so I kind of used his words against my words. And he was very pro aid station, pro getting Marines home. He was very concerned about his Marines, and he thought this was the best thought. Now, of course, as with anything, there's always the concern of security, myself and my team getting shot, killed, drugged through the streets. That all was presented to me as a problem. And those are life's risks, and you have to accept them depending on what your job is. And I saw myself as this being my job with my team, and that the Marines would, again, I had already separated that. Marines are security, we're medical care. We'll do what we can, listen to security, and move forward to get Marines off the battlefield.
Yeah, no, that was really an inspiring story. And before I ask the next question, just let the audience know that they can use the chat feature on Facebook and submit questions, and my team here are going to provide those to me so that I can ask them of Dr. Jaddick. But so my next question was, so that was an enormous recognizing, you know, your battalion leadership's desire to absolutely do all they could to save the lives of the Marines, still took a significant amount of trust on their part that you could set up that forward aid station and not be an encumbrance to them, you know, that you would be able to keep up with them in terms of maneuver. And so I thought a particularly important point, you know, for future medical officers on the operational side, and very important as we continue to tilt even more toward readiness, was the time that you took ahead of time to establish the relationships with your senior leadership. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. When I took this job to go with the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, I was actually the MEB surgeon at the time. I was working for General O'Dell, and he was a two-star. And we were running the anti-terrorist brigade, and I knew that 1-8 needed somebody to go with them, and I had just left the MU with 1-8. I knew some of the officers. I didn't know them all, but it wasn't long. It was about 2 weeks after I said to General O'Dell, I think it's time for me to move on, go back to 1-8. They need somebody, and he was good with that, and I went over, and my first moves were to hit all of the company commanders to make sure that they knew who I was, how much I could help them, what my support would be to them in just going to the dam and seeing sick call, B, making sure that their Marines were, you know, were doing what they were supposed to physically, medically. And then as soon as I met all of and got involved with all of the leadership, I spent some time with the XO, because as everybody knows, the executive officer has to deal with all of the Marines who may or may not be so excited about going overseas. And we sat down and went through all those records and said, well, this guy is probably really hurt, and this guy is not so hurt. And we sorted out trying to keep our battalion at good strength, and we sorted that out. And I think that bought me a lot of points with the XO, because I wasn't the medical officer who just said, no, they all look really sick, we shouldn't take them. I was the one who said, well, I can medically manage whatever this situation is overseas pretty easily. So that bought me points. I don't want to say points. It just, they understood that I understood the mission of this unit, and the mission is to go overseas. And at that point, we weren't going to Fallujah, but we were going to do patrolling throughout and around the Haditha Dam to look for bad guys. And I understood that, and they understood that I understood it. So it moved pretty easily from there to knowing the platoon commanders. And then what I always found extremely helpful is knowing the senior enlisted, the staff sergeants, the gunnery sergeants, the first sergeants, sergeants major, and letting them know I was there for them, that I had a bunch of enlisted corpsmen. I had a chief at the time, and he was fantastic, and he easily got me into that group of people. So there was respect on both sides. I had to earn it, and I think I did that in Haditha on a couple of occasions, and I began that process of earning respect before ever getting on the boat. And we trained hard for 2 weeks. I took a bunch of corpsmen that came down from Norfolk from the hospital who had never stuck IVs, and we went around from platoons to getting IVs to showing tourniquets to training for 2 weeks before we before we took off. So it was a process of meeting the leadership, letting them know what I could do, and then them seeing that we were training, and we were training with the Marines, for the Marines, and teaching the Marines. And that started the process in some respect.
Yeah, no, that, so that developing that credibility, I mean, we say you can't surge trust. So that was a process that really was, you know, recognizing that you showed up relatively late in the deployment cycle, but that sounds like it was one of your key priorities. And the other priority being the training. So you've got corpsmen, many very junior HNs, HM3s, who haven't been in that environment before. And so how did you prioritize the training that you provided?
Well, that became my chief, myself, and I was the only medical officer, so it was my chief, myself. I had a PA who was assigned to us as well. I had one other senior corpsman who was 26 and a first class. And so the four of us got together and started deciding, you know, what needs to be done in a trauma situation, you know, and stop the bleeding. Resuscitation was key. I went through the ATLS with them in a basic format, and we started literally with our corpsmen just getting IVs and IOs, not practicing IOs, but training them on the IO. Mm-hmm. And the IV was big. I always, with young Marines, young healthy Marines who are traumatic, they're going to have good, easy veins to stick. And if you have to, you go with the IO, but it's easier to train the vein than it is to train an IO without creating some pain. So we would go around from platoon to platoon and talk to the squad leaders, the platoon sergeants, and start to get Marines lined up for IV. We'd stick them with IVs. We'd train anybody to do an IV. And I'm not sure how legal that was. I was told at some point I wasn't supposed to do that. But then we got overseas and we got to Haditha, and it was pretty much do what you need to. And every day, sick call would come, and we would run a trauma protocol on anybody who came through sick call. They would, you know, we'd strip them, we'd IV them, and sick call became very light very quickly. So then we started to round up Marines who would come up and just wanted to learn. So one of my first losses on the battlefield in an ambush was Lonnie Wells, who was a squad leader. And he would bring up, whenever they would not go out on patrol, he would bring up his Marines on the dam, and we would go through all of the trauma stuff that they wanted to learn, you know, IVs. And I'd have the corpsman teaching the IVs. I'd have the corpsman running the trauma, start to talk to the Marines about what they needed to do first. And they would do it. We'd talk about it. We'd train it. We'd practice it. I can't say enough about that. Lonnie would, and unfortunately, Lonnie was the only one we lost out of that particular squad, but the rest of his Marines who were wounded were able to treat themselves and get themselves to us and move on. So that was successful across the board. My corpsman became very good at it over time, and the Marines became pretty good over time, the ones who would spend some time with us.
Yeah, that's impressive. And you did have a bit of an advantage in that during your initial urologic training, you had spent a couple of months up at Shock Trauma in Baltimore. And so can you describe the value of that training? You know, because you hadn't yet completed a surgical residency and you were in a battalion surgeon role, which is generally not filled by a surgeon, yet you were able to do probably more than the average battalion surgeon.
Well, yeah, I think the shock trauma training, I did Washington Hospital Center and shock trauma. I did shock trauma for 3 months, Washington Hospital Center as an intern for a month. But that whole team concept, everybody has a role, is exactly what I taught my corpsman. And everybody has a role. Everybody needs to be on point, listen to the direction that I'm giving or one of my team leaders would be giving, which would be the other PA, and then the medical officer who showed up after, and then my senior corpsman. So those are our four real team leaders. The training that I got up at Shock Trauma was above and beyond anything you can imagine. It was everything and everything and anything all wrapped up into 3 months. The call schedule was grueling. Every third night you were on call and you were up all night coming back. But certainly the amount of experience I had in resuscitation, not, we did operate up there. I didn't do any operating other than chest tubes and cut downs in Fallujah, but I had the opportunity to see what the direction of everything would go. One of the things that I realized from that training was how important blood expanders were. They worked. I know there's a lot of controversy, hypertonic saline over HESPAN, colloids, but I saw colloids work well before we got blood into patients. So I can't carry blood onto the battlefield, but I can carry colloids. So we did a lot of the HESPAN resuscitation and straight up fluids, just trying to get as much fluid in these guys as possible, because if they didn't have a pulse and I was able to get one with some expanders and some fluid, you know, I'd let the general surgeons take care of that when they got them back then. But they'd always complain I overloaded them with fluid. I didn't really feel too bad about their complaining. The truth was, you know, the training that I got out of that Shock Trauma, and I don't even know if the Navy's doing it anymore, but it not only did they train me, but they showed me how to train my corpsman, you know, because you have to pick and choose what's going to work, in an austere environment. And I was able to really kind of pare it down to the essentials, you know, stop the bleeding, resuscitate, and make sure you're saving limbs, these kinds of things. And it came out to become a nice little package that I brought to the dam when we finally got up there and started really forward aid station training.
That's really admirable. I will tell you, just to bring you up to date, I actually just was down in San Antonio last week at the schoolhouse, A school, and all of the A school students graduate having completed TCCC, so trauma critical care training. We also, after they do their PQS at an MTF, we then arrange for them to go to one of six level one trauma centers and get additional trauma training. So we've learned a lot from your experience and been able to apply that. We're also for trauma teams, because that's the ideal, as you describe. We've got a new arrangement with the University of Pennsylvania that we'll be starting to send teams there with a cadre, a training cadre in place, very similar to what's done out at LA Trauma. So just some reassurance that we have learned a lot from your experience and from our years in the desert. So thank you for that. I have a question from the audience, this is from Lieutenant Commander Jennifer Angkulowe, and I apologize if I mispronounced your name. But the idea is that clearly the book focuses on trauma care, and that makes sense given the environment. But were there any, did you have to deal with any significant mental health or psychological issues? And how did you do that in that environment?
Yeah, the mental health issues were not, we did have some, and we had some significant mental health issues. We started to lose some Marines in Haditha, and then we were doing a lot of sweeping. The engineers were doing mine sweeping down roads, some of the MSRs. And I did have one of my Marines, I was out on a patrol down in the little village, came back that night, and there was a sergeant who I knew him, I just hadn't seen him that day, but he came into sick call and had really started to crack, according to my PA. So they took him down to Al-Asad and put him in touch with a psychiatrist down there who happened to be an Air Force psychiatrist. Unfortunately for me at that time was once the Air Force got them, they put them into the system to send them to Baghdad, where there was a mental health hospital down there, actually. And so here's, you know, one of the lessons I learned, be careful as you get through echelons of care where you send Marines, because Marine colonels don't like to not know where their Marines are. And when I came out of that, that little, came off my little patrol and came back to the boss, he said, hey, they sent Sergeant so-and-so down to Al-Asad, and Sergeant so-and-so is no longer at Al-Asad. I want to know where he was, where he is. So that led me to 7 o'clock that night, taking a motor car down, doing a motor march down to Al-Asad, getting on an airplane flying, or a helicopter flying to Baghdad, and searching Baghdad with his lieutenant looking for this Marine, because there was no handoff of where he was. And finally, we did find him, locate him, 3 days worth of trying to find this hospital, and he was in good hands. And I had to do a psych evaluation on him to say, hey, can he come back to the unit? Does he just need this rest and recuperation, 3 days time? Can he come back? Because that was, at the time, that was what the push was, give them a little bit back in the rear and then get them forward again, because there's some mental health issues that come from leaving your unit. And when you get home, you start to have more issues. So that's where we were trying to work with, but I couldn't, as hard as I, you know, we talked and went through that, he could not come back. So he got sent out. But I would deal with those kinds of issues. After that happened early in my deployment to Haditha. And the nice part was, after that, the rule was nobody leaves here until I see them. And then I would drive down. I had a couple other guys with some stresses and PTS, and I'm not sure I would call it a disorder, but they were having some stress. So we would take them down to Al-Asad. I'd put them in kind of a recovery unit down there. I would go back, but they were not leaving that unit until I came back to pick them up. So there was a couple of things that we did that got people back into the front. And I'm not sure if that's good or bad. I just know that I know people who have gone home without finishing their deployments and had significant issues. And I know people who have gone home after finishing their deployments and have significant issues. I also dealt with the basic run of sick call. And like I said, you have less sick call, the harder you make sick call to go through. So if you come in and every time you come in, the corpsmen are stripping you down and running IVs in you, they start to slow down on how many they want to come up there. So that was my way of trying to slow down sick call. My colonel once said, at one point, I said, sick call, there's nobody here today at a meeting. And he said, how do you not have anybody at sick call? And and the sergeant major chimed in, well, sir, you show up for sick call and see what they do to you, and you won't come to sick call ever again either. So we had a test in town after that, but just to let the Marines know, we were there if they were sick, really sick.
Yeah, no, that's a really an interesting lesson. One comment before we get to the next question. Dr. Jaddick, I read your book before deploying to Afghanistan, and your lessons have stuck with me and helped shape my actions and attitude in the years since. Thank you for sharing your story. And Admiral Gillingham, thank you for hosting this talk. Well, you're welcome, and that's from Dr. Rich Bly.
Thank you.
So this is from Mr. Mike Rode. And the question is, do you have any thoughts about the Medical Corps response in future wars? And I think you're well aware that we're looking at this global power compact and recognizing that the future battle space may be very different. For the Marines, the idea of expeditionary advanced basing operations integrated with so I don't know if you've had an opportunity to think through that, or if you have any thoughts you'd like to share with us.
Battles in the future. I guess, and I've been asked this question a million times, how will we treat medicine in the future, over the rise in medicine, over, you know, I am, you know, what will the battles look like? Are we talking littoral battles? Are we talking terrorism battles? I think all of our future battles, and if you look at some of the enemies we have now, could we go back to a full-on battlefield through, you know, that involves air, land, and sea kind of frontal battles? Are we always going to be in a terrorist asymmetric situation? Not knowing the current Marine Corps doctrine, I will tell you that what will always be the same is you'll need somebody who knows medicine to be there when somebody is injured. There is no supplement for it. There's no drone that's going to drive in and pick up a patient. There's no robot that's going to put a patient back together. It's always going to be a person. And that person has to be ready for that, no matter what the future holds. And being able to get as far forward, again, point of injury, I always tell people, I was trained where they developed the golden hour up in shock trauma. And that was really done on studies about a lot of blunt trauma. If you get blunt trauma to a hospital within an hour, they do well, and over an hour, they don't do as well. Not penetrating trauma, and I talk about this all the time. Point of injury is what it is. You've got to start to stabilize at the point of injury and continually care as they go towards the rear. I've seen the whole aspects of the drones and carrying patients in and out. I'm not sure you get any care on a drone. I think if you do over the horizon, the Ospreys, and that kind of evacuation enables you to put medical personnel on an Osprey as well as maintaining medical personnel forward. There are two things that I always talk about. And one of them, learn the lessons of the past, everything that's out there. Because when I went to Fallujah, the things that I read about, the little internet I had that I would get into was Tet Offensive. I studied the Tet Offensive. I understood the casualty rates at the Tet Offensive. I presented those casualty rates to my colonel, and I remember him saying, "Well, how do we make that lower?" And these are things that I really strove to do by learning through history. And so history is going to produce what we're going to do forward. We can't forget these lessons, and I think we've done that time and time again as a military. We tend to, and I was a Marine in the 80s, and we didn't worry about medical. When we went out training, we did the Marine Corps training, assault type stuff, but never worried about how do we evacuate patients. And so we tend to relearn that every time we go into a conflict. And hopefully, and I'm sure under the Admiral's guidance, we're not going to do that in the future. We just, that learn from the past is key. And secondly, and I say this to everybody, and it sounds so simple and so obvious, is communications. As Marines and medical personnel, you have to have the communications, not only interpersonal communications, but the links that you have, the secure link to call back and let them know what you're dealing with, how can they prepare, what you're sending back. This can be as simple as the radio call saying, I've got this many patients, they're running back, or the chips that we talk about, you know, every time you scan somebody's ID tag, you've already typed in there what they're going to deal with when they get back and they can pull that tag. So the communication is important to learn from history and continuously train. It's the three things that no matter what we do in the future, we're never going to get away from. And we can't forget what we've done in the past.
No, that's terrific. Thanks. And you probably remember we recognized when we were in Jacksonville together that we actually were in Anbar province at the same time. While you were on call in hell, I was and we received many of your patients, and certainly the high success rate that we were able to produce was in no small measure due to the work done at Roll Ash One. So thank you for that. Certainly compelling experience for me as well. Our next question is from Mr. Leonard Thomas. And he says, thank you for sharing your experience. And then specifically, what are your thoughts on deploying Role 2 surgical services with the MAS forward arming and refueling points?
All right, so let me make sure I understand. So talking about putting Role 2s forward at the Army fuel points. I think it's interesting. So we've always been, you know, the logistics train with the Marine Corps aid stations go with the logistics trains and move that. And that's always been doctrine. When you put a roll two that far forward, I always wonder how much stabilization a roll two is going to provide for you if they're that far back, and how are you getting it to them? If you can get airlift into where the close to the point of injury. So if you've got your roll one, your echelon one care forward, you're moving into a helicopter, that really, without surgical intervention, that helicopter or airlift needs to get back to a stabilized hospital, or, and we have that opportunity almost anywhere in the world. You look at Kandahar, in Fallujah, we had the caches, which were before. Now that, and I may be screwing up roll two and roll three, but I think the roll two is that short stabilization process. And I ran a roll two in Afghanistan down in Spin Boldak. We had no holding capacity, had to get rid of patients very quickly, always waiting for a helicopter. What my thoughts were, why do you need me here when you can take that helicopter instead of stopping here, moving all the way to Kandahar where they have significantly more capabilities. So I think every battle scenario, every scenario that you come across will have, it's hard to place a specific footprint on everything. Not knowing where you're going to be your tertiary care, how is all this going to mesh together? I speak mostly from the right there at the point of injury care and getting them back to somebody who can stabilize. If that stabilization, if you stop somewhere in between after picking somebody up and you're 20 minutes into the flight and you could have been 30 minutes and down to Kandahar, I never understood why would you stop in between. If you can, you should be able to stabilize for long enough. And so I guess that, I don't know if that answers the question. The scenario is a little, probably I've been too far out from the military to understand it completely.
clearly very situationally dependent. I mean, the SSTP and TQ, we had Ramadi to the west and we had Fallujah to the east, and both within about 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes by road. And I think that location made a lot of sense. But I'm with you. If you do put them on a helo and it's not that much longer, and you have appropriate assets aboard the helo, then maybe it makes sense to get to the higher echelon of care. We ended up doing quite a few vascular shunts to preserve limb viability that then were converted to reverse saphenous definitive solutions at the roll three. So I think it very much depends on the operational environment. One of the things
I'm sorry. The one thing I would say is, and knowing what you have in front of you and behind you is also important. I know that putting in some shunts, some venous and arterial shunts was probably not in my bailiwick down when I was running a roll too. I had a plastic surgeon and myself. So the two of us would do what we needed to save life, save limb, but the reality is they needed to move on. And knowing exactly the capabilities of what you're comfortable with, and as a urologist, that I could open a belly, I could stop the bleeding, I could pack wounds, I can make them extend their life and their stability. But I wasn't doing a lot of those shunts. So knowing, if you're the guy at that point of injury, knowing what you have behind is going to be important to let them know this guy should not stop at that roll two, should move on. It all is situational, and you're right, because if you got guys like Admiral Gillingham in that position, then you want to send them there. But if you got guys like me in that role too, you may not, unless they have stones.
Yeah, no, that, and thank you for that. That's I think that's really goes to the fine tuning and understanding the battle space, understanding the assets available. Ideally, you know, we raise the bar so that whoever is put in that role to position, we're able to learn from the joint trauma system and have that baseline set of damage control skills. And so I see that happening. And I was just going to mention that in this distributed maritime environment, we had gotten very used to the golden hour, in many cases, the platinum 10 minutes, which is what you were providing in many cases, that in that maritime environment, it may be the brass 96. And so we've got smart folks looking at prolonged field resuscitation and what that looks like, and some exciting work actually that I saw last week in San Antonio about some synthetic agents to preserve oxygen carrying capability. So there's a lot of exciting things happening there to get after some of these challenges that we're going to face. But you adapted to the situation that you had. And again, that innovation was impressive and inspiring. Could you let's change gears a little bit and let's talk about kind of the human side. So I was intrigued by Story Hour and by sitting down with your corpsmen and then an ever enlarging audience to kind of talk about your background. And can you, do you think, did that humanize you to your team? Did that perhaps help cut across the officer enlisted divide and have them even trust you more? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think so. I think being able to relate to everybody's in front of you is pretty important. And it's interesting when you're a Navy officer with Navy enlisted and you're the only Navy officer other than the chaplain, and then Marine officers and Marine enlisted. And it's almost, you got to wear two faces. And when you're in front of the Marines, it's one thing because they do things for a reason. They are very, very strict for a reason. They've got discipline for a reason. Their humor is different on our side, in the Navy side, and even in the medical side. I talk about this on occasion, is it's more of a, the medical piece is more of a, it's a MASH kind of unit. It is, and when I say MASH, I mean like the TV show. You guys have to work together. You can't take it personally when the position gets upset or when the corpsman's really starting to run ragged. You have to be able to at least interpersonalize each other and realize that you're there for each other, because nobody understands what you're going through, and except for you. And so there's 54 of you, and the young guys need an old guy to listen to, and that was me on not just issues of medicine. They needed to listen to me on, they wanted to listen to me on issues of life, of, you know, what kind of dumb things have I done in my life? And I would share with them the dumbest of the dumb. And then I would share with them the things that got me out of not always being the dumb guy. So I think they appreciated that. I was always big with sitting down with each one at some point. I knew their families. I wanted to know their families. I wanted to know what they're all about. And that made us respect each other. And that was important, in that they could respect what we were trying to do, respect the mission, work hard, because they didn't want to let me down. I thought that across the board was without a doubt. And I worked hard because I never wanted to let them down. And when I was there, yes, I knew the Marines, I knew them well, but not as well as the corpsmen did. And the corpsmen who were frontline corpsmen or even in headquarters knew the Marines, they ate with the Marines, they slept with the Marines. When a Marine came in, you know, for them, you know, that's their friend. And so I always wanted to be there for them. So, you know, over time, we did a lot of different things to kind of understand. I never had a disrespect. I never had anybody not understand that I was in charge. And so I think I could bring down the levels where we could joke a little bit more when the time was right. And when the time wasn't right, we were back at business. So the methodology of being in medicine and seeing your friends get shot and killed requires a little more humanity than other jobs. And so that's what I tried to put out there for them all.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. I really had a great mental image of you sitting on that couch that they acquired for you. And I appreciated that. For me, it was a little camp chair that was just my little piece of paradise in the combat tent. So I was impressed also with how much trust you put in HM1 Zimmerman. And, you know, because you, as the only physician there, you really had to rely on him. And so can you talk about that relationship?
Yeah, Zimmerman, I couldn't have asked for somebody better to show up. First of all, he was a troop leader. He was also very serious at what he did, and he wanted to be independent, but understood that I was there, so we were able to work together. And like I would tell him, I respected his opinion as much as he respected my opinion. So when we have something coming in that was just regular sick call, I have any problem asking him, hey, what do you think of this? And he would come up with his thoughts. I'm like, all right, it's not a bad thought. So I gave he deserved a lot of responsibility because I trusted him. And he gave me a lot of respect because I think he trusted me. And we were able to work really well together. He also was a bit of a, he had his leadership philosophy, which was different in a lot of respects. He was very much a prankster and a jokester and all kinds of things that went with that. And he kept the troops in line and still let them get out of line at times. So it was good to have that and know that was going on without having to get myself into the weeds of what was happening down there. He'd come up and tell me what was happening. So he was not only an outstanding medical provider, he was an outstanding leader, and he always really looked out for the troops, which made myself and planning and the chief's job in planning and relationships a lot easier. So I couldn't have done it without him.
Yeah, that's neat. And, you know, one of the themes, and as strange as it may sound, you know, here you are in a probably one of the most intense combat environments since Vietnam. And what comes through is the love that you had for the team, you know, in a very powerful sense, at looking out for them and caring for them. And have you kept in touch? Have you been able to track some of the corpsmen that you served with?
Yes, I do. I talk to a couple of them all the time. One of them, Smitty's here in Atlanta. The chief Foley just retired. He's a master chief. I better watch what I say. He's just retired. He's a great guy. You know, I keep in touch with. There's a bunch of them that I just hear from randomly. I know one of them went on to become a PA. One of the I just talked to one of the Marines. This is an interesting story. One of the Marines. Sam Christ, who in my initial ambush, I didn't know him. I put a tourniquet on his arm. He'd been shot in the arm and the leg, and we bandaged him up, took him out, and sent him home. I ran into him in Afghanistan in 2013. He was a civilian then working intelligence. And he came up to me and said, are you Dr. Jaddick? And we started talking. And he's like, you're the guy ran in out and anyway, so we talked, and I said, yeah, I got you out. I got a picture of you as we pulled you out. And he followed me around for 6 months in Afghanistan and wanted to be a doctor. So he is now finishing his ER residency. agency. So, yeah, I have a lot of, I keep in touch with a lot of these guys, not always, you know, every week, but at least every couple of years. So he just called me. He's about to graduate his ER residency after he did an amazing situation going to Dartmouth and calling me and going and applying to medical school and all this other stuff. So you build these relationships. I've always told these, anybody who wants to listen to me and talk about education and moving on and doing things that involve getting that education, never being satisfied with where you are. And that's kind of what I taught on the battlefield, was we can't ever be satisfied with the fact that we were able to get some of these guys off. Our job should be to get all these guys off. It should be your job to really get as much education as you want, to do the jobs you want to do. And we did a lot of that talking. So yes, I do keep in touch with them, and they can call me out of the blue at any time. And I've gotten this a couple of times, letters of recommendation or whatnot. And I'm more than happy to do that.
Well, that's really terrific. And I'm glad to hear that you've had that opportunity and that you've been able to keep in touch. Unfortunately, we're near the end of the hour. This has truly been a special event for me, and I really appreciate it. I'll tell you that, you know, I spend a fair amount of time in bookstores, and it's always heartwarming to me to see that your book remains on the shelf and is very popular. So that you know, non-military medical individuals can understand, you know, what it is that military physicians and military medical personnel bring to those that they support. But what a great example you are of that. And it's a thrill to see you doing so well and practicing there, in your urologic practice. And so thank you for all that you've done for Navy medicine, for the Marine Corps, and what you continue to do for your patients. So, Rich, Dr. Jaddick, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. I'm going to make this one comment. My post-Marine Corps career, I think I was doing a residency doing a clerkship out in San Diego when you were my attending. I don't know if you even remember that, but there was a lot. The fact that I remember you means you played a heavy part in my learning. I remember doing some spine cases with you that really I had to gird my loins because they were long cases, and I appreciate everything you did.
Well, it was a pleasure, and I'm glad to see that you went on to such great success, and more importantly, the lives that you saved there in Iraq. So all the best to you, and thank you for joining us for the SG's book club, if you will.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.